It doesn't add up today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. President Trump wants to decide who comes into the U.S. using a points-based test that many Americans wouldn't pass.
It's not looking good. I'm 3 points short. I have 27 points, and I need 30 just to get in line.
Plus, I ask if my dog could get a promotion. My Frankie has a vocabulary, sorry to brag here, probably 35, 40 words. Could he be a bomb-sniffing dog?
Not likely.
And speaking of jobs, here's how the man inside the Godzilla suit got into character.
Because I had no guidance, I spent 10 days at the zoo before filming. And every day I watched the elephants, and then the monkeys and the gorillas for inspiration.
Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. It's Tuesday. Glad you could make it here today. So let's see, $1.8 million to invest. I don't have that, so 0 points. I'm over 50, so 0 points for that. It's not looking good. Monica, do you have even $1 million to invest?
I work in public radio, Marco. What do you think?
That's the world's Monica Campbell. I should have known better. Monica and I are adding up our points, pretending we're not Americans and trying to get a visa to come here. You may recall President Trump's proposal to dramatically cut legal immigration and replace our current visa system with a plan that evaluates applicants based on a point system. So, Monica, can you explain the system real quick?
So basically what we're talking about are green cards, and that means legal immigration. So people who want to stay and live in the United States permanently, you know, this is a system that allows people to eventually have a path to citizenship. So this is for people who really want to root in the United States. The green cards, we give out about $1 million a year. What the Trump administration is proposing is to slash that by half and issue about 500,000 green cards a year over the course of about 10 years.
So the category for entrepreneurs who have $1.8 million to invest here in the U.S., I'm thinking these criteria favor a certain category of people.
Yeah, who has that amount of money? I mean, we're talking about people who are wealthy, who have very high-end business ties, probably in the United States. This is for money to be invested in the U.S., so this is like similar to the investor visa or the millionaire visa, another controversial visa. So yeah, you've got to be wealthy to be able to qualify for one part of this point system.
Yeah, but not having that money might not necessarily disqualify you. Anyway, what is your score up to at this point?
I'm still crunching, but it's not looking good.
Okay. The World's Global Nation editor, Monica Campbell, can you stick around a bit?
Sure thing.
Okay, we'll be back later in the show to kick this around some more with Monica. But first, it would seem the big story of the day is this leaked report on climate change. It comes from the U.S. government itself, and it paints a pretty grim picture of where we are and where we're heading. The World's Environment editor, Peter Thompson, has been poring over a copy of the report, and he's here with me. So I gather the New York Times got a copy of this report, Peter.
Yeah, it's a draft report that reviews the latest climate science from around the world. It was put together by 13 federal agencies, including NASA, the EPA, even the Department of Defense. And it was done under a longstanding federal program called the National Climate Assessment. As you said, the Times got a copy of the latest version and it published it online last night, although earlier versions had been available online earlier in the year. It's pretty stark and unequivocal in its findings. It essentially makes clear that climate change is already here, already having significant impacts through rising temperatures, rising sea levels, increased extreme weather events. It makes clear that these impacts will continue to get worse in the U.S. and around the world, and that some of them are locked in no matter what we do, even if we were to stop releasing carbon pollution today. And it also says flat out that humans are primarily responsible for these changes and that, quote, there are no alternative explanations.
Okay, it's extremely concerning stuff, especially now that it's coming from 13 federal agencies. But it's not like any of this is a revelation, is it?
Right. And there are a couple of reasons, though, that this is still an important document at this particular time. I'll let Catherine Hayhoe lay out the first of these. She's a climate scientist at Texas Tech University, and she's one of the lead authors of the report. And she spoke to the BBC NewsHour this morning.
This is the most comprehensive science report that has been published outside of the auspices of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, to my knowledge. It is also the most up-to-date one. It is based on previously published science, but it brings it together in a way that really presents us with a stark and unyielding picture of the tremendous impact humans are having on this planet, and moreover, the importance of the decisions that we are making today to reduce and eventually eliminate our carbon emissions.
So, as Catherine Hayo said there, this report really pulls together the latest and best science on the climate crisis. But it's her last comment that really points to the bigger importance of this document, and that is the timing.
Yeah, I mean, it is a bit astonishing that this report should come out during the Trump administration.
Yeah, and that's the thing. It hasn't officially come out yet. It was actually the result of work done under the Obama administration, which is not to say that it's a political document. As I said, it's part of a long-standing process going back to 1990 that's been carried out under presidents of both parties and really is all about the science, what we know about climate change, what we don't know. But as we know now, as a whole, the Trump administration is extremely hostile to climate science and to the very notion that climate change is happening and humans are largely responsible. And of course, Trump has announced that the U.S. will pull out of the global Paris Climate Agreement and has moved to roll back President Obama's biggest efforts to cut climate pollution here in the U.S. So I think that's certainly some part of what Catherine Hayhoe was referring to when she talked about the importance of decisions we make today to really pay attention to this or not. And actually, one of those decisions has to do with this report itself. It still has to go through a final review process. And the Times is reporting that at least some scientists in the field are concerned that the Trump administration will try to block it or at least water it down. I don't know anything about the Times sources on this, of course, and they didn't drop any hints in their article. But one has to imagine that the person who released it to the paper wanted to get it out into the public before the Trump administration had a chance to put on the brakes.
This isn't the only fairly big news this week on the climate front, is it, Peter?
Well, right. As usual, there's a lot going on. But one big piece of news comes from our friends at the BBC who are reporting that countries may be seriously underreporting their greenhouse pollution. And that could be really bad news for our ability to track carbon sources. And it also gets at a potential problem with the Paris Agreement. One of that agreement's major points was that it requires countries to report their emissions and what it plans to do to cut them. But of course, if countries are cheating or if they just aren't able to keep good track, that could undermine the integrity of the entire agreement.
Meantime, as we'll hear in a moment, a lot of the planet is super hot today.
Yeah, we've seen off-the-charts heat so far this year in the U.S., in the Southwest, in the Northwest, and in Europe. And temperature data from NOAA, that's the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration here in the U.S., shows that the first half of this year was the second hottest first half of a year on record, which in a sense is not that surprising because the last 3 years have each been hotter than the previous one and each one the hottest year on record. But scientists were expecting this year to be a good deal cooler because last year was pushed over the top by an El Nino event, which really increases global temperatures generally. This year, it's not El Nino. They expected them to fall considerably, and they didn't. So that is just the latest worrying piece of news on the climate front.
The world's environment editor, Peter Thompson, there. We can't say for sure whether climate change is to blame for any specific instance of weird weather around the globe, but I bet a lot of people in Europe are wondering about that right now. They're suffering through a serious heat wave there that even has a hellish nickname, Lucifer, and it's deadly. In Romania, two people have died. In Serbia, it is so hot that train tracks are warping, so public transportation has slowed to a crawl. And in Italy, people are crowding the beaches, and over at the Uffizi Gallery in Florence, the AC went on the fritz, and they had to close the museum. We thought we'd check in with writer Lorenzo Valecchi in Rome. I hear that some fountains in Rome, those famous fountains, are getting turned off, Lorenzo. So how hot has it gotten in Italy, and how long have you been dealing with this heat?
Yeah, it's been incredibly hot in the last 2 weeks, I would say it. And personally, I have lived in Rome for many years now. I do not remember a heat wave like this one in the past. We've had temperatures above 110 degrees steadily for the last number of days. Rome usually takes most of its water from a lake nearby, and the level of the water in the lake has decreased to a point where it's now kind of a muddy swamp, no more a lake. another effect of the heat wave are fires. There was one fire that blocked the railway line that runs along the lake in the morning. And in the afternoon, from where I was on the lakeshore, I could see a fire just starting and developing incredibly quickly with this very high plumes of smoke and high flames visible from about a kilometer away. Firefighters were, you know, hard-pressed to deal with all these fires in one small, single little spot near Rome, for instance.
Mm. With the hazard this heat poses to human health, what kind of warnings is the government issuing?
Well, the government is telling especially more vulnerable people like elderly and kids not to venture outside during the day, pretty much, to stay indoors as much as possible, especially if they have air conditioning. Otherwise, go to places with air conditioning, like, you know, museums or shopping malls or stores or whatever that might be, so that they can try and deal with the heat wave better. Drink a lot. The price of water has increased here in Rome. It's noticeable that, you know, instead of paying, for instance, €1 for a small little bottle of water, now you'll pay two or three,
wow,
especially if you buy it on the street.
So some people finding spots that are air conditioned to stay cool. But culturally, I understand in Italy, air conditioning is not that common. What's that about? And without air conditioning, I mean, how do people cope?
Yeah, you're right. Traditionally, it's not particularly common. It's become more common in the last few years, but there's no way to cope without air conditioning except then staying inside with all your windows and curtains closed off and shuttered so that you try to keep the heat out, even if it becomes really stuffy inside. That's one way of doing it.
So you were recently in Tuscany. How has that area been affected? That's north of Rome.
Yeah, that's north of Rome. It's really hot. And if you can find a positive effect of the heat wave in Tuscany, for instance, is that this year we'll have a great vintage in terms of grape harvest and wine production. Because it's been so hot and it's rained so little, the wine this year will be great. The harvest, which is usually in September, has been anticipated as we speak.
Wow, instance, almost like a month early.
A full month earlier, almost, yes. They're already harvesting grapes because they're ready.
So in the summer of 2003, there was a heat wave similar to this that landed in Europe. 20,000 people died, and I know we're nowhere near that level. Many of them were elderly, living in France. But are people making the comparison to 2003?
Yes, they are. And the heat wave has not it's not over yet. It's not finished. But we will see how it compares to 2003. Personally, just based on my experience, this year, at least here in Rome, has been, I would say, much hotter than 2003.
Really?
Because we had temperatures well above 110 degrees for a number of days. And in the last few days, I think temperatures of almost 120, 130 degrees were recorded near Naples, for
wow,
instance. It boggles the mind, frankly.
How are you coping, Lorenzo?
I have air conditioning, thankfully.
So culturally, it's not a problem for you.
But you know what? In the last number of years, I only used to use air conditioning for maybe 2-3 days a year because in the end, you know, it's bearable. And as you say, we're not used to using air conditioning a lot. So a lot of Italians prefer not to use air conditioning, even if they have it. So in the last few years, only a few days. This year, I think I've kept it on for the last 2 weeks, 24 hours a day almost.
Lorenzo Valecchi, a writer based in Rome, thanks very much for being with us.
You're welcome.
If you're a dog lover, then you'll want to tune in tomorrow for a story we've been working on about golden retrievers. Turns out there are a lot of stray goldens on the streets of Istanbul, and some of them have pretty rough lives.
They are calm. They don't know how to fight for their food. And when big dogs approach the food, the golden retrievers run away.
So rescue groups are airlifting them to the U.S.
Clara is going in a big crate because she's fat. We have an obese Clara. She's going in a suite.
Goldens get new lives in the U.S. That's tomorrow here on the show. Battling HIV in South Africa by battling violence against women there. That's just ahead. You're with the world.
I like words.
A podcast.
Elegant, flowery words.
About language.
Tonsorial.
The world in words.
Grapple. Jostle.
The world in words.
Crunchy, crackly words.
Get it on Apple Podcasts.
Or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. You're tuned to The World. We're going to spend the next few minutes in South Africa. First, some dramatic political news. The country's president, Jacob Zuma, was in danger of losing his job today. Opponents have accused Zuma and his party, the ANC, of rampant corruption and cronyism, and they introduced a no-confidence motion against the president in the country's parliament. Today, Musi Maimane of the opposition Democratic Alliance Party urged lawmakers to vote Zuma out.
Today, our choice is between right and wrong, between good and evil. Today, we do what is best for our country, or we turn our back on it.
But the vote went Zuma's way, narrowly. He avoided being ousted by only 21 votes. Afterwards, Zuma addressed his supporters.
I've just come to say thank you to all of you. Those comrades who are in parliament needed the support from the membership and supporters. You came in your numbers to demonstrate that the ANC is there, is powerful, is big, it's difficult to defeat the ANC.
But Zuma's critics have made it clear that they will not give up the fight. Julius Malema is a former ANC member. He's now the leader of the Economic Freedom Fighters Party.
This country does not belong to Jacob Zuma and his family. It belongs to us. And we are here to send that message only, that the country belongs to us. And if Zuma fails to preside over this country, we will take it from him and assign it to people who will respect the Constitution.
South African politician Julius Malema speaking there after President Zuma survived a no-confidence vote in Parliament today. We stay in South Africa now. Our Across Women's Lives team is there this week, reporting from the front lines of the fight against HIV in the country. One of the things that is fueling the epidemic in South Africa is violence against women. Reporter Jasmine Garz has part two of our series, and a quick warning, her story includes some sexually explicit language.
Zianda Kamte says she looked out the bus window the whole way to Cape Town. She says she never stopped looking back. She was terrified that he would pop into her view, coming to get her and their two kids.
My husband, he changed. And so he started being abusive, beating me, treating me like nothing.
She says when you leave your marriage one morning after your husband has had breakfast and gone to work, it feels impulsive, frantic, and unplanned, even though it took months to make the decision.
Because there were days that he would come home at 4 a.m. in the morning, and then he will just want us to, like, jump into it and make love.
He was a police officer. After work, he'd go drinking. She says she knew he was cheating.
When he wants us to be sexual active, then I will ask him to wear a condom.
Zianda would ask him to wear a condom. She was terrified of getting HIV. South Africa is the country with the highest number of infections in the world, nearly 20% of the adult population. And Zianda had seen this play out before. Years earlier, her aunt had died a slow, painful death from AIDS.
We used to visit her in hospital. You could tell that, no, this is something different. She had it, but at the time, people were not, like, really being honest about it.
Zianda is 32. Her generation has been educated about HIV and how to prevent the infection. But she says her husband was enraged by the idea of using a condom with his own wife.
And then he will beat me up because I will say, I refused. So I was trying to protect myself, but he didn't see that way.
There is a lesser-known, silent epidemic here in South Africa. This country has one of the highest rates of rape in the world.
We've got to address the sexual violence in our country because that is really driving HIV in this country, and it still does.
Dr. Marlene Wasserman is a sex therapist. She grew up during apartheid, a brutal system that kept the minority whites in power. She says the system was built on a myth.
White women have to be scared because we were always taught black men are going to kill you or rape you.
When apartheid fell in the mid-90s, Wasserman says there was a wave of rape reports, but not along the lines of that racialized myth.
And then it became, more and more evident once the sensationalism of it died and once people found a voice, what was really going on. Everyone's been raped. Everybody's being raped.
Wasserman says a lot of the men who rape are trauma survivors themselves. This is a country with a history of racial and class violence. And when the apartheid ended, things were supposed to change. But the truth is...
So you've got people who are economically absolutely, absolutely poverty-stricken and powerless. And so when you have that as a foundation of men who are powerless and not able to provide for themselves or a family, there's a huge amount of anger that happens. And when there's a huge amount of anger, there's a huge amount of violence.
And most of the time, it's an intimate kind of violence. What Zianda went through is not uncommon.
So the whole idea of this strange man who's going to be raping you, you know, be careful, you know, lock yourself up at home, that just kind of crashed. Actually, the man who's raping you is your husband.
Hello.
A bar outside of Soweto, Johannesburg, where the air is thick with weed smoke, is the realm of men. It's cold and dark. Men in jackets nurse bottles of beer, playing pool.
Okay, this booklet that I'm having on my hand, it's called Men's Guide to the Sexual Offences Act.
This is Abu Bakr Sibella. He's a familiar face at these taverns. There's only one woman here. She's sitting in a corner. As Sibella walks by, she asks, "What? Did you come here to teach me how to have sex?" The short answer is yes. Sibella and his team work for a nonprofit called Sonke Gender Justice. They talk to men throughout Johannesburg about violence and HIV and how one leads to another.
So the reason why, again, we are here is to also get your buy-in as men and say, "Not in my name."
The men stare, glassy-eyed, as he talks. When he's done, a few come up to him. One guy wants to know where he can get HIV tested. Another man wants to report a rape. But mostly, there's a lot of slurred jokes.
But we also get abused from the women.
You have to wonder if anyone is absorbing this information.
It is quite frustrating.
Outside the bar, Sibella tells me it certainly doesn't help that the South African legal system has been slow to recognize violence against women. It wasn't until 2012 that the first marital rape case was won. That's why he keeps coming back to these bars.
But what I have seen, or what we have seen in the work that we do, actually men are more open when they are in such spaces and when they are intoxicated, because then in that they speak their mind and how they feel.
There are a myriad of ways to stop HIV in South Africa, like making condoms available to everyone, encouraging abstinence, and encouraging people to get tested and know their status. But when it comes to solving the violence that is fueling this epidemic, the answer is not just in a health clinic. The answer is also right here, in a dimly lit bar in Johannesburg. For the World, Jasmine Garst, South Africa.
Tomorrow, we'll spend more time with Zianda, the woman at the beginning of Jasmine's story. This is The World.
What would the news sound like if media were diverse?
Things get racialized here. Muslim is this weird racial thing here, and I don't think our parents were prepared for that.
I'm Rupa Shenoy, host of the podcast Otherhood. Listen to what you're missing on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. A port in Maine struggled for decades. Then the port director got a call from a guy who wanted to ship something to Turkey.
I said, "They want to ship pregnant cows out of Eastport." He said, "Yes." I said, "How are they going to do it?" "They're going to put them in boxes." At this point in time, I honestly thought it was half a joke.
But it was not a joke. Hear more about that still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Earlier on the show, The World's Monica Campbell and I were trying to determine our odds of getting into the U.S. if Congress were to approve President Trump's new points-based immigration plan. Anyone outside the U.S. who wants to emigrate here must rack up at least 30 points from several categories just to get in line for the visa. So, Monica, let's pretend once again we're not citizens. How's it looking for you?
It's not looking good. I'm 3 points short. I have 27 points and I need 30 just to get in line. So I'm not going to get into the U.S. anytime soon.
What category or categories didn't work out too well for you?
Well, I got a master's degree in Latin American studies, which doesn't count because it's not a professional degree like a law degree or an MBA. So I guess that education didn't really get me far. I didn't earn an individual Olympic medal. I mean, I could have earned a group Olympic medal, but I didn't earn an individual Olympic medal. That would have gotten me another 15 points. I don't have a Nobel Prize, so I didn't get that extra 25 points. And of course, I don't have that more than $1 million to invest in the United States. So I'm out of the running.
Yeah, you know, it's extraordinary. I got 31 points, just enough to squeak by the 30-point mark. But being over 50 earns me 0 points, and I could easily see a scenario where I don't have a job offer, at least not a radio host job offer. And even if I were a little younger, I wouldn't qualify to get in line for the visa, which is kind of mind-boggling. So how is this system different from the one the U.S. uses now to evaluate would-be immigrants?
Well, part of it is that this proposal really drastically lowers the number of family-based visas that are issued. So what we're talking about is like a lot of people who try and get family-based visas are from Mexico, China, the Philippines. You know, they've been living in the United States. They might not be wealthy people, but they have family outside the U.S. that they want to bring in. So there's a number of visas that are allowed. Well, you're allowed to get in line for those visas. The line is very long. This system is really strongly reducing those family-based visas and giving more emphasis on people who can pass this test.
President Trump is fond of saying how this new system is very similar to the one they use in Canada. Is that a good comparison?
It's a comparison to a point. It's brought up a lot. Trump did mention it. But there's some really key differences. And one is that Canada's system started a while ago, and it's really been modified over the years. And what its current system is very flexible, and there's built-in flexibility that reflects that kind of shifting labor demands in Canada, both on the low and high end of the labor market. So if you look at the points-based system that Trump is supporting, it's for a high-end labor market. Canada has room in its system for people who are not in that high-end market. So, for example, construction workers or food prep workers. So there's different types of categories within the point system. Canada also does let you add some of those points in there if you have direct, close family members in Canada. So that helps.
So if you want to emigrate to the U.S. and you're not highly skilled, you don't have a PhD or $1 million to invest, does the Trump administration think the U.S. economy has room for you?
It does. I mean, what we're seeing is, you know, something that exists to a point already, which is kind of a two-tiered system. We have the first tier, which is the one that we're talking about, green cards, come into the United States, live legally, permanently, you can become a citizen, you can vote one day. That's one tier. Second tier is, you know, come to the United States as a seasonal worker, as a temp worker, as a guest worker. H-1B visas for high-skilled workers in Silicon Valley, other workers for agricultural, you know, people working in the fields. There's visas for people who work in, you know, resorts, seasonal resorts like Mar-a-Lago. So those people, they come in with a visa, legal, but they have to leave. So they don't really get easily a crack at living in the United States, becoming a permanent resident, and eventually voting, you know, eventually becoming a citizen. So what you're seeing is kind of like a two-tier way of life, you know, a permanent resident, perhaps a citizen one day, and then somebody who kind of cycles in and out and never really gets that permanent foothold in the United States.
I mean, the idea of a points or merit-based program also has fans among Republicans and Democrats. Do you think we're likely to continue hearing about it?
It's one area because there are other models around the world and there's been tests, you know, in other countries and we've seen how those systems have evolved in other countries. It's one area where you can actually have a discussion. I mean, there is a discussion to have when it comes to how the U.S. immigration system is set up.
The World's Monica Campbell, our Global Nation editor. Thanks very much for walking us through this, Monica.
You're welcome, Marco.
We have a project here at The World called 50 States. We're visiting cities and towns across the country to get a sense of how globalization is affecting communities like yours. Today, we head to Eastport, Maine. As its name suggests, Eastport is the easternmost port in the U.S. The city has survived more than 200 years living off the sea. And as The World's Jason Margolis reports, it's been a constant tale of reinvention.
Eastport's population is 1,352. It has a handful of restaurants in the tiny downtown. During winter, they're mostly closed. Washington County is one of the poorest parts of the United States. The area struggles with high unemployment and opioid abuse.
We've had a lot of deaths from overdoses. Five people that I knew last year died, or the kids that I know died. It's horrible.
That's ship pilot Bob Peacock. We spoke at the city's downtown port. We'll hear more from him in a bit. A century ago, it was a different story in Eastport. It was the sardine capital of America. Regular ferries ran from here to Boston. Kristen McKinley, who founded the Tides Institute and Museum of Art in town, shows me a photo of Eastport from that time. Three boys, ages 7 to 9, standing in front of a pile of sardines.
They would be pulled out of school, there would be a whistle blown, and there'd be whistles for different factories, so they'd hear the whistle, and then they would run down the hills downtown with the knives with them, and then work until the fish were gone.
By the 1980s, Eastport's sardine industry was diminished, but still flourishing.
They were also making cosmetic glitter from the colorful slime off the back of the scales. It's called pearl essence. There were three pearl essence factories here.
Chris Bartlett is a commercial fishing specialist with the University of Maine who lives in town. He says eventually sardines and other fishing businesses dried up, and the town did too.
Our elementary school was built to house 250 students from K through 12. We now have 86 students there.
The area still does have salmon farming and lobster fishing, and its port. A few years back, the Eastport Port Authority got an unusual phone call. A port employee relayed the information to the port's director, Chris Gardner, that a Texas company was looking for a place to ship cows to Turkey. Pregnant cows.
I said, they want to ship pregnant cows out of Eastport. He said, yes. I said, how are they going to do it? They're going to put them in boxes. At this point in time, I honestly thought it was half a joke. But I realized it wasn't. And he said, what should I tell them? I said, well, simply, Skip, tell them, of course, yes. He said, we have no idea how to do this. I said, exactly, and neither does anyone else.
And so for 3 years, the town was kind of booming again. Then in 2014, the cow exports collapsed when southern Turkey became too unstable. Again, ship pilot Bob Peacock.
It's funny, in an international situation, when you're a port like this, what happens anywhere in the world affects you. And you figure that out pretty quick when your income comes from piloting ships and all of a sudden there's no ships because of a war in Syria. It's a very interesting setup.
So what do? You build off the cows, says Chris Gardner.
What was most important from the cows is it illustrated that new things can happen. Here we have literally the deepest natural seaport, not in our county, not in our state, but in the nation. And with all the changes that are taking place in global shipping, for a rural county who is just looking for a way out, well, why couldn't this be that way out?
It's also the closest American port to Europe, but it's isolated, tucked away in the extreme northeast corner of the country. And some residents, like retired teacher and bed and breakfast owner Gregory Noyce, aren't convinced by the sales pitch.
I'm not sure that it's realistic. There's no way, as far as I can tell, to get goods out of Eastport. There's not a major highway. There's not a rail service. There needs to be a way to get goods and services in and out easily.
Many here share that concern, including people working around the port. Then enter Donald Trump and his talk of rebuilding America's infrastructure. Ship pilot Bob Peacock liked that.
When he talked about infrastructure, I think most people in this area understood exactly what he's talking about.
That's because one of Eastport's piers collapsed 3 years ago.
It created a tsunami in the harbor that went up and got the windows in the bottom of these buildings.
It happened in the middle of the night. Only one person was injured, but it's costing more than $15 million to fix. The federal government is picking up half that tab. Let's go back to Chris Gardner one last time. He hopes Washington will keep investing in his community.
We're going to be pushing on that. Because quite honestly, with the deepest natural seaport in the United States of America, how do you not connect that to a railroad? Especially when it's in one of the poorest counties this nation has. It's a conversation that needs to be had and will be had. So this asset exists. There is the political will and climate to see this port grow. And all we need is that infrastructure.
Question is, are Washington politicians and President Trump willing to invest potentially tens or hundreds of millions of dollars into a city of 1,352 to back that up. For The World, Jason Margolis, Eastport, Maine.
If you'd like to be part of our 50 states coverage, just go to PRI.org and tell us your story and how globalization is affecting your community. Or just tweet us using the hashtag 50 states. Now an update on the story of an olive farmer in France. His name is Cédric Héroux. He lives along the French-Italian border in an area where migrants often cross from one country to another. And he was put on trial for helping those migrants. Today, a court handed Héroux a 4-month suspended jail sentence. Reporter Adeline Sey has been following the story, and she joins us now from Paris. So just remind us what Cédric Héroux was on trial for, Adele.
Well, the court says he illegally helped migrants. And it's a little murky because he himself says he was not caught, at least recently, helping migrants cross the border. He may have done that in the past and was told, obviously, you cannot do that anymore, which he says he stopped doing. So this time it's a little bit more murky because he simply says that migrants come to his doorstep and he's just helping them out. Right now, he's housing about 40 people, including 20 minors, 20 unaccompanied minors. Over the years, this is someone who has helped hundreds of people. So he was very disappointed by this verdict, obviously. And I spoke to him earlier today, and this is what he said. So Héroux is saying, we have no choice. People show up on my doorstep. So if I don't do anything, I violate the Good Samaritan law. So what value does this law have in a society in which people who apply it are punished for it? It's kind of schizophrenic, he says.
What is that Good Samaritan law that Héroux brought up when you were speaking with him? What is it and how did that play out during his trial?
Yeah, so in France, there's a law that, let's just say you happen to walk by a river and you see someone drowning and someone who obviously needs help getting out of the river. You're not just morally, but legally bound to call for help. Or help yourself if you can. Or you could be tried for that. And, a lot of people feel like migrants are in this situation. They may not be drowning in front of your eyes, but they may be starving or they may be cold in the winter. And this is why you absolutely have to help out. There's also a 2012 law regarding humanitarian help, which says that you can't be penalized for taking measures to help people's, safety and dignity. So it's really confusing why he would have any kind of sentence at all in this case.
So this place where Cédric Héroux lives, it's called the Roya Valley, also known as the Rebel Valley. Why is that?
Yeah, so La Roya Valley has a French side and an Italian side. It's in southeastern France, on the border of Italy. There are many farmers there. And imagine, you're basically minding your own business, growing olives or chickens or whatever, and then migrants come to your doorstep because you happen to live on the border with Italy. Well, obviously, these people, they were just helping out. So, in fact, there's a lot of people, actually, who got in trouble helping out people who have crossed the Libyan desert and the Mediterranean Sea, a lot of them kids. And so they feel compelled to help and therefore defy authorities. That's why they've been called rebels.
Right. So this trial of Héroux and his sentence of time served, should it also be seen as a message to members of the community in the Roya Valley and beyond to just stop helping migrants?
Yeah. He definitely. His lawyer and himself, they say this political trial that the government is trying to appeal and appease, frankly, right-wing fringes who are putting pressure on the government to deal with this crisis just flatly refused to take any more people in. President Macron has said he doesn't want to see any more people in the streets of Paris or, sleeping in the streets or anything like that. But we haven't seen so far, a plan unveiled. And so Cédric Héroux, the farmer, said he would love to actually have President Macron come over so he could show him exactly what is happening.
I got to say, Adele, Cédric Héroux's story has got echoes of the resistance during World War II, people helping other people because it's the right thing to do, even if the law might not be on their side. Have any French been making that comparison?
Well, absolutely. There's still a lot of people who remember World War II and what happened then and feel a lot of compassion and compelled to help. So you see a lot of people making these comparisons all the time.
Adeline Sia in Paris, thanks very much for the update, Adele.
You're welcome, Marco.
Dogs, they are our best friends. They keep us company. They know when we're happy and when we're sad. They give us unconditional love. And despite all the technology, dogs are still the best way to find a bomb. The bad news on this front is that there's a worldwide shortage of bomb-sniffing dogs, and the U.S. is in need of a few good ones. A lot of good ones, actually. Kate Murphy wrote about this in a revealing article for the New York Times. So in this day and age, Kate, with all the chemical detection technology we've got, how are dogs still the best way to detect explosives?
Well, they have many more receptors in their nose than human beings. And certainly you can try and build a machine that has that many receptors in it, but they can't be as sensitive or discerning as a dog's nose, nor can they crawl around underneath seats, get into overhead bins, go around stadium seats the way a dog can. They're also not as curious as a dog. Mm. And anyone who's owned a dog knows that a dog will ferret out anything. They will find even the tiniest morsel that a kid throws on the floor, and the dog will find it. And that is by virtue of their nose.
It's still all about the nose. I know the TSA favors German Shepherds and German Short-haired Pointers and Vizslas. I've got a mutt, but I know he's really smart, and he's not one of those. What does it take to be a bomb-sniffing dog? Because my Frankie has a vocabulary, sorry to brag here, probably 35, 40 words. Could he be a bomb-sniffing dog?
Not likely.
Why not? What does it take?
These dogs are, you know, bred for actually centuries to be the best sniffers in the world, and they are mainly bred in Europe. In the United States, as you know, if you've ever watched the Westminster Dog Show, those dogs are bred to be pretty. They're bred to be companions. They're bred to be dogs that aren't going to tear up your house. And in interviewing the breeders who breed these dogs, particularly in Europe, they say that the dogs that are the best are the dogs that, quote unquote, consume foster parents. Like in Sweden, they're sent home for the first year to live with a foster parent. And the dogs that would generally be euthanized in our shelters here, because they're the dogs that would tear up their cage, the dogs that would spin around in circles, they're the dogs that are just incredibly curious. They're the dogs that want to find that thing, whatever it is. And when they're told, this is what you'll be rewarded for, if you find this thing that smells like an explosive, these dogs cannot, I mean, they almost can't stand it. They have to go find it. They've got to get it.
So what are some of the countries that are known for having these dogs that are really good at this? I mean, you mentioned Sweden and the kind of fostering. Are there other places?
It's really Germany and the Netherlands is where it started, but you know, they're keeping those dogs for themselves now. And so now they're being bred primarily in Eastern Europe, where they can be bred in little farmhouses out in the countryside where they don't have the economic advantages of some of the Western European countries. And so it's kind of like this puppy mill industry, and these vendors go over there and they look for these dogs and then they buy them and then they flip them for a lot more money, where they sell them in Germany and the Netherlands.
Yeah, a lot of money. How much do they go for, some of these dogs?
The high range is $25,000, and that's for a fully trained dog. But dogs that are, as they say, green, that haven't been trained yet, they might go for anywhere from $5,000, $10,000, $15,000. It's really, you know, they're just being bid up at the moment because it's supply and demand. And the Chinese and the Saudis are going in there and they're paying top dollar. They're paying $25,000. And the United States, the military, the government agencies that are looking for these dogs, they can't pay that kind of money. So they're not getting the really good dogs.
How long is the average working life of a bomb-sniffing dog, and who adopts them when they retire?
It's about 8 to 10 years, and a lot of times the handlers actually don't want to give up the dog. I mean, here they've spent their entire life with them, so they take the dog home with them. There were some people, I mean, it was really quite touching because I interviewed some of them, and some of them said, no, I really didn't want to take the dog home with me because it would be so unfair that I'd be walking out the door with the other dog.
Oh.
To go do the job, and then that dog would be, you know, looking at me with sad eyes, like, why don't I get to go?
I could have been a contender.
Exactly. If it isn't the handler, then they do, you know, put out calls to the community to see who might want to adopt the dogs.
What about you, Kate? Did you fall in love with any of these dogs?
Oh, my God, yes. In fact, they had to kind of slap my hand a few times from petting the dogs because you're not supposed to pet them.
Did you think about taking anyone home?
Yes. In fact, I'm still thinking about it.
Kate Murphy writes for the New York Times. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Okay, that was not a dog. That was Godzilla. When the monster first hit movie screens in Japan, it was 1954, and the role of Godzilla was literally a guy just wearing a monster suit. That guy was Haruo Nakajima. We just learned of his death at the age of 88. It's hard to imagine a man in a monster suit getting typecast, but Nakajima played Godzilla on screen 12 times and finally retired from the gig in the mid-1970s. But that first time, in 1954, that was epic. Nakajima's original Godzilla suit reportedly weighed over 200 pounds. In post-war Japan, rubber was in short supply, so the suit had to be made from, believe it or not, ready-mix concrete. In interviews, Nakajima recalled sweating like crazy inside, and as he told the BBC a few years back, the suit wasn't even the right size.
The original Godzilla suit was not designed with my measurements in mind. It was bigger, so I kind of rattled around inside.
Nakajima started out as a stuntman in samurai and war films. His characters used to die in battle a lot. So playing a monster that emerges from the deep after a nuclear test, that was totally new for him. And according to Nakajima, director Ishiro Honda didn't really tell him how to play the role.
Because I had no guidance, I spent 10 days at the zoo before filming. And every day I watched the elephants, and then the monkeys and the gorillas for inspiration. Then the special effects director advised me to watch King Kong, which was filmed in stop-motion animation, so one frame at a time. I asked him, how long would it take for us to film like that? And he answered, 7 years, and we only have 3 months. That's why you're going to wear the suit for this movie.
Nakajima and his 200-pound monster suit were a hit for almost two decades. His last outing in the suit was in 1972. There have been many Godzilla movies made since, and more to come, I'm sure, but Haruo Nakajima will live on as the one and only original. Bit of the soundtrack from that original 1954 Godzilla. Love the strings, guys. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
Public Radio International.